Good morning, Council. Last case on our calendar today is A24-0219, State of Minnesota versus Philip Eugene Turner. Council will each have 15 minutes for your argument, and appellant will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. I'll just ask that you introduce yourself and the party you're representing at the beginning of your argument. There is a clock that shows the time remaining. And so you can proceed when you're ready.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Paul Sellers. I represent the appellant, Mr. Philip Turner. The case before you involves a situation where police, in conducting an investigation, sought to locate a cell phone associated with Mr. Turner. And they did so by contacting directly with the cell phone provider and requesting real-time cell site location information. They did not obtain a warrant for that. And they did so in direct violation of Minnesota Statute 626A.42. This isn't a new statute. This is been litigated by the Supreme Court several times. It's been
so, counsel, that there wasn't any argument raised related to that statute at the district court level, correct?
That's correct. Counsel for Mr. Turner, the trial counsel, moved to suppress, offered several theories, but didn't specifically cite to 626A.42. The counsel
is that argument waived under State v. Roby?
I don't think it is.
Or forfeited?
I don't think that it is. I think, first of all, the court could conclude that moving to suppress, and they do it, I think it's document 46, they specifically ask for suppression because of a lack of a warrant. And that's specifically what the statute calls for here. Number two, it's clear that they're asking for suppression for lack of a warrant. And this is just an alternative theory. It would be like, an example would be the Supreme Court's case, State v. Jones, where no one at the trial court level suggests that the violation of installing the tracking device was based on an originalist understanding of trespass to chattels. But they preserved the argument that there was a violation of their client's rights. And the court held that by preserving that argument, if there was an alternative theory that also supported their argument, even though it wasn't specifically raised, that that was allowed to hold through. If the court concludes that, well, so number one, that they did raise the issue about suppression. In addition to that, this is an incredibly well-known statute. It's baffling that neither party nor the trial court seem to be aware of this statute. And the statute is controlling. And so if even without them bringing up the specific statute, the statute provided Mr. Turner with the relief that he was seeking.
But when you say the district court doesn't appear to be aware of it, I mean, it's the district court's duty to address the arguments that are raised by the parties. And if the argument isn't raised, why would the district court assume that it's before it? And what would be the basis for us to say the district court acted erroneously under the law by not addressing an argument that was not presented?
Well, so the district court would have had the ability to say, well, this statute controls. And certainly the district court could say this statute is directly on point and controls this issue. But even apart from that, that's why I raised the issue of ineffective assistance, because the defense, Mr. Turner's trial counsel, specifically is seeking relief of suppression based on this warrantless search. And that's specifically what they're seeking. And there is a statute that is directly on point that addresses this exact issue and that has been litigated to the Supreme Court. It's been addressed. And somehow they don't raise that, even though they should have been aware of it. And by not citing to that statute, then they provided ineffective assistance of counsel.
Well, is the record adequate for us to address that argument when we don't know why it doesn't appear to me on the record before us, we don't know why defense counsel didn't raise that argument.
I don't think the court needs to know why they didn't. The court knows that they were seeking suppression. The court knows that they were seeking suppression because of a warrantless search.
Well, they made other arguments in support of suppression based on the Constitution.
They certainly did. And so it's...
And as respondent argues in respondent's brief, state argues that, you know, that potentially the statute is subject to exceptions under the Fourth Amendment. Now, you disagree with that, but, you know, maybe there was a trial strategy to focus on the Constitution rather than the statute because of that. In other words, it's not clear to me that the record is sufficient for us to make that determination about ineffective assistance of counsel, but help me understand why you think it is.
I think it is because they clearly moved for suppression and they wanted this suppressed. And that's not questioned from the record. They filed multiple motions. In fact, they filed, I think, three different times they tried to attack this specific issue. And the specific reason they cited was for the lack of warrant. And the relief that they were seeking was suppression. This statute would have given them exactly what they wanted, because the statute, if applied to this case, would have excluded all of that evidence. And a statute that gives them all of their relief that would have been available to them is never discussed, never brought up. There's no reason for that when it would have given them everything that they wanted. The only conclusion that the court can
draw. Doesn't the statute governs when a warrant is appropriate? And they were arguing that the information obtained by the warrant should be suppressed for violation of the Constitution. I'm trying to understand how would this statute that only governs when a warrant is appropriate, that being what the steps you need to do, how do you extend it, so on and so forth, how is that going to affect kind of the trial strategy? And again, getting back to Judge Corcoran's question, I'm having a hard time understanding how this statute plays with the trial strategy, given the nature of the specific statute.
So I don't think there's any strategic reason why they wouldn't have used it. It doesn't make any sense. As far as how it would have provided them with the exact same relief, so the statute is very clear. And this is, a number of states began citing these statutes. I talk about that in my brief, but I think 15 other states passed these statutory relief, because several federal courts began interpreting cell site information, and they concluded, much similar to what the district court here concluded, that you don't get that specific relief you're looking for that trial counsel wanted under the Fourth Amendment. So a number of states, Minnesota, 15 others, all passed specific statutory relief from the legislature to require a warrant. Minnesota did that. And in fact, the state acknowledges, or the Minnesota Supreme Court acknowledged that in State v. Harvey, and this court did in State v. Libel, acknowledges that that statute provides that type of relief. And the statute specifically requires that a warrant is obtained before gathering this information, unless one of the exceptions apply, and none of the exceptions apply in here. Now, I know counsel argues
the statute, assuming it were to apply, says no evidence obtained in violation of this section shall be admissible in any criminal proceeding. The evidence that was obtained was his location. Correct?
Correct.
So how does this statute prohibit the other evidence that the admission of the other evidence that Mr. Turner's counsel was seeking to suppress through the motion to suppress?
For the same reason that they argue in their motion is that the warrantless search provided law enforcement officers with his location. And then therefore that information is fruit of the poisonous tree. And all the evidence that they gather off of him is fruit of the poisonous tree.
But counsel, wouldn't that have been discovered? It's my understanding in reading the record that from the beginning, they knew his address. And I guess I would need clarification. It's my understanding that law enforcement actually was surveilling the house. And really all this provided was real-time information of whether or not he was there. So absent this information, let's say they don't have this data, they're looking at the house. Weren't they going to see him come out eventually anyway?
So I disagree with that. I think the record shows that they searched a number of addresses. They were looking at a number of places. This was one of a number of places that he had been associated with.
And I guess just for clarification, because was this data obtained before or after they started to surveil the house?
So it's not entirely clear. What we know is that they began surveilling, that they were aware of this address, that 1 or 2 hours, could have been 2 hours before he's arrested, they begin this warrantless tracking of his. They looked at this address. The record talks about them going to other addresses, going to a Walmart parking lot, continue to look. They saw nothing at this address. The only reason that they continued to search and check this address is that was what the cell site location showed, was that he was there, that they had been monitoring, they saw nothing. The report said we saw absolutely nothing.
Were they still, and again, I guess I would need clarification. You're indicating they were surveilling the house. They were surveilling other places, and this data indicated that, yeah, he's in the house. At any point did they stop surveilling this particular house, then got the data and said, oh, wait, nope, he's here? Or was it they're surveilling, and while they're surveilling, they just got more information to determine that he's in the place that we've been monitoring?
So I would say the record's not entirely clear, but my understanding in reading the transcript is that they began surveilling this address. They didn't find him. They didn't see anything suspicious or important. They either stopped or began searching other places. And it isn't until they have this 2 hour period where they're getting that cell site information that he's there that they continue to surveil this. But for knowing that the cell phone associated.
And then you're saying you're saying that surveillance, then that surveillance that they continued based on the cell site information is what led to his apprehension, which led to the discovery of the information.
That's correct. That confirms that this of a number of possible locations where he may be, that gives them confirmation that we're going to just continue to sit on this address.
Counsel, your time is running low. I wanted to turn to your argument about Rule 9.02 and the disclosure of the Illinois convictions. And in your brief, you argue that counsel's disclosure of the Illinois conviction violated his Fifth Amendment rights. And you cite a few cases on page 18, but they seem factually distinguishable. So can you address that argument?
So this is a unique fact pattern I've never seen before, where a defendant in consultation with his attorneys, which he fully believes to be protected by attorney-client privilege, discloses that he has this conviction. And the attorneys then feel duty-bound by Rule 9, and apparently, according to the record, to the Board of Professional Responsibility, that somehow placed Rule 9 above their own client's right to privilege with his attorney and directed his attorneys to disclose this conviction, which they only knew about from privileged conversation.
And how does that violate his Fifth Amendment right against, how does that rule compel him to be a witness against himself in violation of the Fifth Amendment?
Well, so, you know, I think it's less about may I just finish?
Sure.
It's less about him being compelled. It's about his Fifth Amendment right to effective counsel. And when he is trying to have...
It's a Sixth Amendment right?
I understand that. But one of the portions of that is, it's a blending of the Fifth and Sixth, because I talk about the failure to provide an adequate defense. But by compelling his statement delivered in private to them, they hold that, they determine that Rule 9 then compels his statement to be disclosed to the state. Essentially, it's forcing him to be a witness against himself, because this statement made to his attorneys then is being used against him.
So you're saying, if I understand, I'm sorry, your time has expired, Mayor.
Sure.
I gather your argument is that his attorney then is his agent, and the rule compelling the attorney effectively compels him?
His statement, it compels him to become a witness against himself, because...
Is there case law that would support that linkage that you're making between the communication to the attorney and the attorney's relaying that information over to the state, that somehow that implicates the Fifth Amendment?
Well, the only thing I would say is I cited the cases, and I think the quote is that the encroachment of defendant's rights is an attempt to force him to disclose the contents of his own mind. He is aware of this conviction.
Well, I understand that. I understand that as the Fifth Amendment. My question, though, is this sort of relay that went on here. The client communicates to the attorney. The attorney feels compelled under the rule to disclose this to the court and the state. And it's the therefore that I'm not sure I'm making connection with, which is that therefore it is a Fifth Amendment right that's being violated, as opposed to some other arguable fairness issue. Is there a case that supports that linkage?
I think Judge Cochran addressed it. There's not directly on point, but the language, I think the privilege protects against any disclosures that the witness reasonably believes could be used in a criminal prosecution or lead to other evidence.
Is that correct? I mean, so I guess the answer to my question is yes or no. You found a case that supports that linkage, that this makes it a Fifth Amendment issue?
Yes, the Castiger versus United States case, it's the language from that case that I think applies here.
Thank you. You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Jim Haas. I'm an assistant Olmsted County attorney, and I represent the state of Minnesota in this case. As I was preparing for oral argument, after having set this aside for some time and dusting this off, often is the case, things dawn on you that maybe didn't before, things that maybe were so obvious you might have just walked right past it. And a couple of those things appeared to me, things that were even addressed in the district court's omnibus order. That is document 64 in the record. And as I reviewed the district court's omnibus order, the district court makes a point of noting that one of the well-known exceptions to the warrant requirement is if there is probable cause for a felony arrest. And the district court finds here that, of course, there is probable cause to arrest Mr. Turner based on everything that the police knew at that time that they arrested him, and that searching his backpack is a lawful search incident to the arrest. And in some ways, the arguments here maybe conflate the terms of a search warrant versus an arrest warrant. And I would suggest that what we're really dealing with here is not so much a search, but we're dealing with an arrest, which led to some evidence in the backpack. But I think the real linchpin, the center of gravity here that I think can solve this problem in a single fashion, is the pistol. And I'd sent a letter of supplemental authority to the court earlier this week, citing the case of State versus Carbo, dealing with the subjective expectation of privacy that is usually lost when an object is abandoned. And the court notes that we've held that when property is left in a public place where the defendant can no longer expect privacy and the police may lawfully be present.
They were present as a result of the pinging of the phone. Would you agree with that?
I disagree, Your Honor.
Okay.
And I think the facts in the record, as I've argued in my brief, were that the police knew very well that Mr. Turner's primary residence was the one at the Whalen Lane address.
I saw that in the record as well, but there is a little bit of ambiguity about it. Sounded like they searched other addresses that had been associated with Mr. Turner. This Whalers Lane, I believe it is, Whalers address was on their list, but correct me if I'm wrong, but it didn't appear that they had actually gone to that address before the pinging of the phone.
Well, maybe 2 points to that. Had this statutory claim been raised in the district court and we were dealing with other than just constitutional issues, it may have dawned on the parties, at least the state, that, hey, maybe we really need to develop a more defined timeline here, which could be done, frankly, quite readily when you have the time date stamp on body-worn cameras, the GPS locations, the call notes from dispatch. There's a lot of objective evidence that would lay out a timeline for this. Our position is the record shows that the police were already surveilling the house when Mr. Turner walked out the door. And they knew his address because it was the same address that was on his driver's license.
But counsel, were they already surveilling the house because they were there before, or were they surveilling the house because they said, oh, we pinged him, we know he's here, so we're just going to wait? Because I think that's a critical, at least in my mind, that's a critical fact as it relates to how important this ping information was. If it were that the police were just there, okay, but.
The testimony was that the officer that requested the warrant already knew about this address, and they knew about it through a variety of sources. Not only was there, you know, as we know now,
but knowing about the address and being there, the reason for being there, I don't know that that response addresses the concern that I have that Judge Harris, I think, is the premise of Judge Harris's question, which is the police were there, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, because of the ping and because they knew it was his address, not just because they knew. Not just because they related the address to him. Is that accurate or not accurate?
My understanding of the record is that before they requested the warrant, that this was the primary address for a couple of sources. One, they look at police reports, and I think testimony talked about calls to that address. They said this was the first one we had. It's the last one we had. This was the address that had the closest nexus to Mr. Turner. They also ran the registration of his Mercedes that was parked in the Domino's, at the pizza place. And again, I think that, they could have fleshed this out more, but long, just like his driver's license, they had more vehicle records as well. So between police reports, other records, they weren't as specific as they could have been, but they knew this address and they said, this is the one that came up the most. This is the one we had associated with the most. They knew that before They pinged his phone before they requested the warrant. I think the record is, I think the facts are that they were physically surveilling the house.
And what would you point us to for that?
Well, they were certainly surveilling the house when he walked out the door.
Right, but they had already had the ping at that point.
The testimony, I can tell you the page. On page 9 of my brief, at the bottom of the page, I state Detective Jacobson testified that he already knew about Turner's address at 3300 Whalers Lane, Northwest, before he directed Amy Urkey to submit the exigent request form.
But counsel, the issue isn't whether or not he knew about the address. It seems to me they worked up and they knew about a number of addresses. The question was, did they know he was there, and was the ping the key evidence that alerted them that this is where he's at? Not that this is an address that he may have been at, because it seems to me that he was at a number of addresses, and they had a number of addresses that he could have been at. So again, the question is about the ping, and whether or not that was the key evidence or not.
So is your, I'm not sure.
I guess
maybe you restate the question, Your Honor.
The question is, because you continue to indicate that testimony is that officers knew of this address. And it seems to me that we would all agree that, yes, officers knew that this was an address that he could be at. The question was whether or not their surveillance and their information that they got from surveillance is what led to his arrest, or was it that they got the ping and they realized not that this was an address that he would be at, but this is the address he is at. So we're going to wait for him. Then he comes out. So the question was, is it the former or is it the latter?
Well, I try to do as best I could with the timeline. It's not exact, but we know the time. At least there's a date stamp on the facts of the exigent warrant request. And he was arrested within an hour of that or so. And we know that from the body cam footage that's in the record of the date timestamp when the, I can't remember who it was, but he was already under arrest when that officer came up and came to the scene. Mr. Turner had already been arrested, and we have the date timestamp on that body camera. So this is happening perhaps concurrently, but it's my belief that the officers were physically there before they even requested the warrant. My belief is. Now, again, had this issue been raised, there might have been more details to try to lay that out. But
is the argument regarding Minnesota Statute 6268.42 properly before us, or was that forfeited?
Well,
in your brief, you address it under the plain air standard, but I have a preliminary question before we go there.
Well, in any case of plain error, I mean, if it's not properly raised below, it's forfeited. But then the district court or the appellate courts have the discretion to review for plain error. So I think it's within the court's discretion to review it for plain error if they wish. But yes, our position is.
And if a legal argument is not raised below, State v. Roby suggests that it may be forfeited versus an objection at trial.
Yeah, our position, it's forfeited, but it may be.
But we can analyze it under plain error.
Yes, I think the court has that discretion to do that. But let me come back to just this initial notion, though, of was it obtained in violation of the order? I come back to the fact of, regardless of why the police might be in a public place, the police can be in any public place there. There's nothing restricting the police from surveilling this address, being in that area. The police found this pistol abandoned in the snow. Mr. Turner wanted to distance himself from that, and he abandoned that property in the snow. Our position is really he has no expectation of privacy in that pistol. I mean, if it were found a day later, would it, you know? So, and with that pistol, of course, comes evidence of, there was some DNA evidence from the pistol. Of course, it matched the ballistics from the residence. But setting that aside, as we argue in our brief, really, what the pistol does, it connects Mr. Turner to that location. But there was no way that he could distance himself from that location with the evidence in the record. And of course, his own statements to the police, he conceded he was there. In fact, he ultimately came around and told the police that Ms. Riddell killed herself, or shot herself rather, with the shot herself with the gun. So from the standpoint of a remedy here, I don't see that it gives rise to the relief that's being sought. Even if we suppress, the remedy here really is suppression. That's what's being sought. Suppress the gun, suppress the magazine, suppress the ammunition that was found. Even if this court were to grant that relief in this case, it really wouldn't change the outcome of the trial or the strategy, because Mr. Turner was on video entering and leaving the apartment. There were eyewitnesses that put him at the scene of the crime within hours of the death. Their relationship was well known.
Can we turn to the argument related to Rule 9.02? And appellant argues that the disclosure of the criminal conviction, which was conveyed by Mr. Turner to his defense counsel, violated the Fifth Amendment. Can you address that argument? Why isn't that compelling him to testify against himself when the attorney could be viewed as a conduit for, you know, his testimony, since the information came from him?
That he had a conviction.
Mm-hmm.
Well, a couple of factors. As a matter of fact, Mr. Turner disclosed this conviction to the police in a statement before he even had an attorney.
So I don't know that he disclosed the conviction.
Well,
I think the conviction part of it was unknown. The charge was disclosed.
I cited to this case of State v. Malzack to the Minnesota Supreme Court in my brief from 1976. And in that case, there was some work product of a ballistic expert report that a defense hired expert had produced. And the defense attorney then disclosed this report that was implicated in the trial. And the Minnesota Supreme Court rejected that argument, really the same argument, flat out upholding Rule 902. They noted it's based on the ABA standards for criminal justice. And the Supreme Court had no problem with the rule. But they pointed out, I think more importantly, that this didn't originate with the defendant.
And in that case, it was a ballistics report from an expert, I believe, right?
Yes.
Whereas here, it's information from the defendant himself.
It's public record.
It's public record, but it was disclosed. The disclosure was information provided by the defendant.
Right. But then we still have to look at, was there some prejudicial impact of that under a Strickland standard? And our position is no. We look up and confirm people's criminal histories all the time. This was a matter of public record. To that extent, I would say it's not even a confidential. I mean, he may have just explained that he has this conviction, but it's not a secret or a confidential fact that isn't publicly known.
Can you address the structure of the argument is what I'm curious about. The notion that communicating to an attorney and the attorney communicates that to the state and the court. I'd like you to address whether that is a Fifth Amendment violation, just as a matter of structure. Does that fall within the rubric of the Fifth Amendment?
I guess I have a difficult time understanding how it would, Your Honor, considering the other context of the rule of the other disclosures. And I see my time is up. May I continue, Your Honor?
You may.
Considering all the other disclosures that the defendant has to make to the state, alibi, self-defense, other disclosures, alternative perpetrator, there's many other listed things.
Both are defenses.
Well,
we're talking about, we're talking about inculpatory information. I'm trying to get a sense of whether, as a matter of constitutional law, this falls under the Fifth Amendment protection. And if not, are you aware of any case that answers one way or the other?
I'm just unaware of a case that directly implicates that. I guess we analyzed it under the rules and the cases we find. I just don't know of a case that addresses it. I'm not saying it doesn't exist. I'm just unaware of one, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Any further questions? All right. Thank you. Mr. Sellers, you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. One thing that we've kind of talked around a little bit, or I know counsel addressed in his brief, is the relation or the suggestion that the legislature somehow intruded into the evidentiary realm of the court when it enacted the statute 626A.42, and that there is somehow that law enforcement would still get the exceptions for like exigency or something like that. And I would just note that a comparable, and I know in an unpublished case, this court has kind of dealt with this, but a comparable statute would be Minnesota Statute 13.824, which is the license plate reader statute. And that in that statute, it specifically says exigent circumstances. The legislature is aware of how they could phrase this. They could phrase it as exigent circumstance. They could phrase it as that they chose the specific language in here to provide the most protections to their citizens. So I think that's important. Another thing I just want to be clear. It is the defense's contention that but for the cell site location information, Mr. Turner and the firearm and the magazine would not have been found. I just want that to be clear that is.
Expand upon that a little.
Yes. In the state's own brief, they concede that the cell site was used for an hour or two. They concede that officers had this as a number of addresses that were available. In fact, I think the primary reason they picked this address was he was linked to it in a police report or something like that, that they had been surveilling, but then those people who'd been surveilling left. And it almost seems to match up with the timeline that the reason that they resumed surveillance was that when they get this cell site information, then they sit on this address for an hour or two because that's where they believe he is because of this warrantless search of his cell phone data. And counsel says this should best be fleshed out at the district court. And that is true as to this specific issue. That is the relief that we're asking, is that it be remanded to the district court so the court can appropriately apply this statute to determine whether Mr. Turner's rights were violated under that statute.
Can I ask you a question about the Fifth Amendment, your Fifth Amendment argument?
Yes.
What is there in Castigar that supports the proposition that you're asserting, which is that a defendant who communicates to an attorney and then the attorney relays that information onto the state creates a Fifth Amendment issue?
So it's that, and I will concede that there isn't a case like this on point. I've never seen this issue before. The issue is the client provides this information to his attorneys, and it appears that the rules requires it. The rule requires.
But just to be clear, that's not the circumstance in Castigar.
No, I understand that. It's more the broader language
of the Fifth Amendment protection.
Of the Fifth Amendment protection.
Right. Okay. I get that. I don't think that's in dispute. My question is just as a matter of law. I've never seen a case, and I didn't see any in your brief, Castigar included, where the Fifth Amendment is at all implicated when the idea of compelled testimony against oneself by communicating to a person. Communicating to one's lawyer, and then the lawyer feels compelled by a rule.
I understand that, but if there wasn't a lawyer in this case, if he had been pro se, he would still be bound by the rule to disclose any prior convictions. That's what the rule would require. So whether it's through the agent of an attorney, it requires the defendant to become a witness against himself to provide evidence that the state could use, and they did.
Does it matter that it's a public record?
But the state conceded that they hadn't found it yet. It was an Illinois case.
They could have.
It's possible that they could have, but they hadn't yet.
Correct.
And they hadn't charged him with this charge. And in fact, it's also quite possible that they never do track it down in Illinois. And that's the key here, is that but for this, the state conceded this at the trial court level, but for this disclosure, They may not have had it. The disclosure caused him to be charged with a felon in possession, which then was sentenced
first.
Were
you able to find, okay, that brings up a different issue. Were you able to find, if I could, anywhere in our law or throughout, anywhere else in the country, whether federal or state case, that obligatory disclosure requirements like this or convictions, disclosure of public records implicates the Fifth Amendment, even when there's not an attorney involved, as you've said, what if it's the, what if he's pro se? Were you, have you found any case that supports the notion that that circumstance of mandatory disclosure implicates the Fifth Amendment?
I have not.
Any further questions?
No, that's all.
All right. All right. Thank you to counsel for your helpful argument here today. We appreciate the argument of both counsel, and the matter is submitted. We will issue our opinion within the statutory time. That concludes our calendar today. We are now in recess. I'm happy to say, though, we have some students here from a local youth and law group, and we are going to, the panel is going to stay after and answer questions and chat with them for a few minutes. So everyone has a good day.